You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this Brookings event that we're doing in partnership with our friends at Out in National Security and representatives of other organizations from around the world on how Africa is handling the COVID crisis at this juncture as we get further and further into the summer of 2020, as defined here, at least in the Northern Hemisphere, and try to understand the way in which a continent of 54 countries and more than a billion people is trying to handle this greatest transcontinental health crisis of our lifetimes. I've got the privilege of moderating an event with an amazing group of panelists. As I just said, I'll introduce them briefly in just a moment. Our basic approach today is going to be to speak amongst the five of us for a little bit as I pose some broad questions. And then in the second half or so of the hour, we'll go to your questions that you can still send in at events@brookings.edu if you wish to do so by email if you haven't already. Again, events@brookings.edu. But I'd like to one more time reiterate that we're doing this in conjunction with our good friends at Out in National Security, a remarkable organization. And we're doing this through Brookings with the Africa Security Initiative. As you may see on your screen already, we have folks from multiple locations around the world. Zoe Marks is at Harvard. She is an expert on Sierra Leone, where she's done a great deal of field work and research. She also thinks and writes about gender issues across the continent and the world, and we're very fortunate to have her with us today. As I move clockwise around the screen, at least as my screen shows, we have Yusuf Travali, who is speaking to us live from Kigali, Rwanda. Very happy to have him there. He's with the Friends of Europe, and he's also a scientist, which makes sense given the topic today and the crisis that the world is facing. His PhD is in material science, but he's certainly looked at and studied and worked on a number of issues in general fields of science and technology. And so I'm sure he'll be helping us today to understand some of the implications of COVID in Africa at a technical level, as well as at a policy level. Xander Mies is at the University of Pennsylvania at the Center on Ethics and the Rule of Law. She's an attorney. She thinks, as you might have guessed, about how the court system, legal systems around the world operate and how they can perhaps at this juncture be relevant in addressing challenges from the COVID crisis as well. And Desiree Cormier-Smith is a former U.S. Foreign Service officer with expertise and experience in South Africa, who has also worked with Madeleine Albright in her amazing work around the world, and now is at the Open Society Foundation, thinking about a number of issues in terms of human rights, in terms of response to this crisis at that sort of level as well. The way we'll proceed now is that I'm just going to ask each panelist for 3 or 4 minutes to define an aspect of the problem of COVID-19 in Africa. And by aspect, I mean one or two particular countries or one or two particular dimensions of the problem. As you've heard, some of our panelists are experts on law, some on human rights, some on gender issues, some on technical aspects of COVID. And of course, what I'd like to do is really just get a few ideas on the table here in the opening and then go to a second round in which we can follow up and maybe ask questions and make comments about each other's initial thoughts before we move forward to audience Q&A. So without further ado, and appropriately enough, starting from our panelist who is now in the heart of Africa, where he currently again resides in Kigali, Rwanda. Yusuf, over to you, my friend, and thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Michael, for this introduction. Good morning, everyone, or good afternoon, depending on where you are. So basically, as a way of very quick introduction, I will give a very brief overview on Africa responses to COVID-19. And according to me, when it comes down to Africa's responses to COVID-19, I think it's very important that we focus on what has worked and see under which framework condition those positive experiences can be replicated across the continent. So what I can say for sure as a key lesson is that many countries in Africa have taken the opportunity to combine emergency healthcare with protocols and innovation to improve response effectiveness. So basically my takeaway today from Africa responses, so I have four takeaways that I would like to share with you. The first one is that we really need to develop going forward, really need to develop robust digital infrastructure and master digital technologies. That's the number one. The number two takeaway is that we really need to develop testing and actually decentralized testing capacities and clinical trial capacities across the continent. The third takeaway is that we really need to foster the presence of strong manufacturing-based capacity across the continent. And because we have seen that the countries with strong manufacturing capacity have been able to convert those industry and make masks or other health care equipment. And then the last takeaway, which is actually might be unexpected, is that we need to foster better alignment between urban planning and health emergency slash health foresight. So it's really critical that we start to look at urban planning in that angle if we have to face future shocks. So where do we go from there? I think if we want to prepare for future shocks, whether they are economic or sanitary shocks, we really need to agree on a continental, or I would say a transcontinental wide framework with what I see as five areas of intervention. So the first one is really physical infrastructure. We need to improve that. The second one is digital infrastructure, which we need to improve. The third one is really the policy and regulatory environment, where we need to work very seriously. And then the last one, I think the fourth one, it has to do with digital technologies. So I see a set of 10 digital technologies that we need to harness. And then the last one, it's really the having a conducive environment for startups, more conducive than what we have today, because we have seen the critical role of startups in supporting government in the fight against COVID. And I think what is central to this framework is that we really need to come up with innovative financial instruments to boost innovation ecosystem in Africa. So I will stop here, and then we can discuss in more detail what I've stated here.
Thank you, Youssef, for excellent opening remarks and for your succinctness and conciseness. But let me take advantage of your conciseness to ask you one quick follow-up before we even move on. Since you are the opening speaker and since you are in Africa, I realize you're only in one of 54 countries in Africa, but how would you frame the severity of the crisis right now, either within Central Africa, where you currently reside, or more continent-wide, for a generalist who's watching our show today and doesn't really follow Africa in detail, may have seen a couple of newspaper stories. I'm just wondering how you would measure or gauge the severity of the crisis of COVID in Africa so far. Is it worse than expected? Maybe not quite as bad as expected yet, but maybe the worst is still to come. Is the greater effect on the healthcare sector, or is it more on the economies of Africa that have partly shut down as they've tried to limit contagion? And therefore, perhaps the greater effect is not so much in terms of healthcare as in terms of reduced economic activity. And that would then make us want to worry a lot about getting loans and grants to various African governments, depending on which problem is more serious. So what I'm saying is, could you frame the problem for us at this juncture in July 2020? And other panelists may want to come back to this same question. Just how bad is the COVID crisis in Africa? And is it primarily at this point a health problem or an economics problem? Obviously, it's both, but is it more one than the other?
I think, generally speaking, except South Africa, we are more facing, I would say, an economic problem. It's less severe than expected. If you see a country like Rwanda, I know that Rwanda is a bit exceptional, but I think in 4 months, I think we managed to not exceed 2,000 cases. So we have 1,600 cases of COVID in Rwanda with more than 50% recovery, which is excellent. But what I see, that's why I'm really insisting on financial instrument, I see that we have been relying on foreign aid to support SMEs, to support the private sector in this context. And me looking forward, I really would like African countries to be more resilient if there is such a crisis. This is why I'm talking about really supporting the innovation ecosystem, so that when there is a future shock, we are able, through the money that is generated by our ecosystem, to support the countries. So I think less severe than expected.
Thank you. That's very helpful. Xander, over to you, and including anything you want to say about this broad question, but also your specific legal perspectives and dimensions to the question. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me today. I'm so pleased to be here and join these esteemed fellow panelists. I definitely want to come back to that question. I think there's a lot to talk about on that. Quickly, I would say, I think that long-term there is a real economic issue, but it's a real economic opportunity right now as well. And countries of Africa are well-placed in a way to push back against their past funders in a way that perhaps they haven't had before. And we've seen some leaders, for instance, speak out against China, Chinese leadership, and against the United States and its leadership in other places as well, in an interesting change to the dynamic. And so I would love to come back to that and the economic opportunities that are arising from it. But for the initial question, I think what we see with any crisis is a test of infrastructures and a test of institutions. And the courts are no exception when it comes to this. In around the world, as countries deal with COVID, there is an effect on courts and on justice. What are the extent of the powers that a leader can have? What is the check on that power? Courts are a natural one. But also, who are some of the most vulnerable in a crisis like this? Those within the criminal justice system and those in need of that criminal justice system. So we see COVID, for instance, have outbreaks in prisons in countries in Africa, as well as around the world. And I believe Zoe may talk about this, but vulnerable populations such as women and children who are particularly affected in times like this, also needing those courts to help them. And how is that going to happen? So some of the specific examples, though, that we've seen in the last few months of these dynamics in play include in South Africa, which, as Yusuf has said, has seen some of the most severe effects of the health aspects of this, but they're not alone. I mean, very quickly after it became clear that this was a pandemic, we saw 17 countries on the continent declare states of emergency, 9 declare states of public health emergency, and 3 declare states of natural disaster. And there is a troubled history of countries on the continent declaring states of public emergency and what that might mean and the powers that come from that. But I think that we have seen here in the last few months an interesting dynamic where as leaders have tried to take decisive action with public shutdowns, with the economy, but also in other aspects of government service, you see challenges to that in courts. And we see the courts push back. We see courts push back and say, no, these powers, these measures that you've taken are constitutional, for instance, but these are not because they are not narrowly tailored. We see courts push back and say, yes, you do have the authority to do this. However, our law calls for you, for example, in Namibia, to submit an affidavit and you did not, right? So there is this pushback of we have rules, they actually must be followed. We see also a struggle, though, with at those lower levels in the criminal justice system, what cases can go forward with not. And Yusuf talked about technology. I think that we've seen some really creative uses of technology when it comes to the courts as to how to continue them going forward. And one of the most interesting places for that is which cases are considered urgent and imminent enough to require court action. And this is where we see, for instance, tensions on issues of domestic violence and how the courts can still act in a time like this to protect those most vulnerable. I'll leave it at that. And I believe Zoe is going to be talking more about the role of women and children here. So
thank you very much. And I'll just allow the smooth transition to Zoe, since we do have some continuity in subject matter before I come up with follow-up questions later on. So Zoe, thank you for being with us today, and over to you.
Great. Thanks so much, Mike, for the invitation to be here. And it's wonderful to meet my co-panelists. It's particularly valuable to be able to connect transcontinentally, even through the medium of Zoom these days, because I think I speak for a lot of people who don't live in Africa, but spend most of our time thinking about it. It's incredibly difficult to speak about countries on the continent when I haven't been in the past 12 months. So I'm running up against my comfort level of being able to talk about countries that change so rapidly. And I haven't been in Africa since the crisis broke out. So I want to preface my comments by saying the biggest challenge, I think, for us to think globally and to share solutions and to share what's working and to also like pinpoint weak spots and vulnerabilities, the biggest challenge is actually just access to information. And so I will talk about gender inequalities and vulnerable populations, particularly in the African context. But I want to start just by saying that one of the biggest challenges in African countries and here in the US, I'm calling in from Cambridge, Massachusetts, one of the biggest challenges has been lack of disaggregated data and lack of real-time data. And Yusuf sort of set this up in talking about the importance of harnessing digital technology and strengthening testing capacity. What we really need to be doing in African countries, as much as my home country here, is trying to ensure that testing is rapid and efficient, but that it's also public and transparent, and that it's the right indicators that are being collected. So, there's a lot of variation in how we could think about the severity of a crisis, particularly in specific communities. And what we've seen with community transmission is that not only is there sort of lag time, I think a lot of us have been watching trends across the continent with bated breath. I'm certainly not optimistic at this stage that Africa is going to come out sort of without more severe outbreaks than what we've seen, but there's definitely been a lot more lead time for African countries and African governments to prepare. And so what I'm looking for right now is there going to be accurate and effective data quick enough about populations in different parts of the countries that we're looking at so that we can have tailored responses? And so I think with gender and gender inequality, it's a great microcosm of how lack of good data and lack of disaggregated data can really drive inequalities in a health crisis. And so what we know about COVID sort of runs into very quick limits when we look at pregnant women and when we look at, sort of antenatal care, what the impact is on a pregnancy, what the impact is on a baby who's born during COVID. And there's a sort of health system effect there, but then there's also if a woman is infected with coronavirus during her pregnancy, we have very little information about what will happen. And so that's just sort of one indicator of how we can think about why we would want disaggregated data about health effects of coronavirus and where the disease is spreading. Another example of why we would need disaggregated data at this stage is we don't know the rate of transmission in urban communities versus rural communities. It looks like rural communities are slightly insulated through dispersal. We know that the sort of shutdown of markets had a really harmful effect on rural agrarian communities' access to cash. But we also know that there was a bit of a buffer because they usually are subsistence farmers throughout Africa and have more access to producing their own food. So there are some interesting new survey results that Innovations for Poverty Action did in Malawi and Liberia with sort of the poorest of the poor rural subsistence farmers that found that there was not an impact on their food security, but there was a significant negative impact so far of lockdowns on their access to cash. And so that's going to have knock-on effects for, families' ability to invest in their children's education, to access other forms of basic medical care, to access basic treatments and preventative care that has otherwise just sort of become available in rural communities. And so these are some of the ways that I think we can begin thinking about what types of disaggregated data we need in order to have a tailored response. And what I really want to avoid is this sort of we all run to the fire and we miss the embers that have been sort of spilling over long distances, where we start to see that all of the health gains that were made in the sort of very basic delivery of antenatal care, postnatal care, access to early child development, nutrition, medicines, that would become corroded because of disruptions to the supply chain at even just the within country level. And so that brings me to sort of the second point that I wanted to use my first few minutes to talk about, which is thinking about social protection and how can we think about social protection efficiently at this time, knowing that governments are incredibly resource strapped. So one of the things that I haven't seen quite as much discussion about, but I look forward to hearing from co-panelists and any of the audience questions, is really the interruption to aid funding. I think we've seen an initial flush of resources, which is really valuable. But in the long term, it looks like the projected aid that's being made available is 50% less than last year. And so there's been a dramatic rollback from wealthy countries who've been profiting off of Africa for centuries, a dramatic rollback in the aid that's going to be provided. And that's just looking at planned or committed aid expenditures. It's not even looking at what's been paid out. We've also seen the United States has obviously withdrawn from WHO. I think that that is, there's a lot that could be said there. It's highly political, but it also shows a sort of blatant unwillingness to support and follow African and international multilateral leadership. I think that's something that the continent has been doing really well, but if it doesn't have kind of global support, I do worry a bit about what the kind of high level implications are, particularly for vulnerable communities. And so to sort of try to stay within the framework of thinking about inequality, thinking about gender inequality is a great way to think about what these kind of global knock-on effects look like. And so there are, I think, really big questions about how governments are going to be able to allocate and prioritize both getting their economies back up and running and maintaining social protection for some of that sort of insulation that we need that's not COVID specific, but actually everything else specific. Because a country like Sierra Leone, for example, is almost entirely commodity dependent for foreign exchange. And so they only just last week reopened flights, which meant that the entire government didn't have access to foreign exchange revenues for the past 3 or 4 months. And so that has really drawn down the resources. And so we see that households are actually a microcosm of the state in some ways. Families have been spending down on savings and they've been going into debt to make it through the sort of lockdown periods and disruptions to markets. Governments have been doing the same. And so I think there's a real opening here to think about who needs to have resources reallocated to them. How can we invest in human capital and continue to educate children so that they don't fall far behind? And how can African governments really support the vulnerable, but also just integrate them into a healthier economy that's not so dependent on foreign exchange and primary commodities? When we're looking at a major demographic boom in the next 60 to 70 years.
Excellent. Thank you. A lot of things I want to follow up on, but I'll hold off on that until round two and bring in Desiree first, who's got, as I mentioned, considerable experience in South Africa, considerable experience with the private sector, now a new position with the Open Society Foundation. So Desiree, over to you, please.
Thank you, and thanks for having me today. I'm going to start off with my usual disclaimer that, you know, as many of the panelists have noted, it's very difficult to talk about Africa in one broad stroke, right? It's 54 distinct, unique countries. And so I'm going to be doing a lot of generalizing today, and some of the things that I say may be accurate in some places and be completely inaccurate in other places. And so I want to make that disclaimer now. But when we're talking about such a huge topic and a huge continent, I think for the purposes of this hour-long discussion, I sort of need to make some broad generalizations. I want to start by saying that COVID has decimated economic and health systems around the globe. So this is not unique to Africa. We've seen it here in the United States and other developed countries like the UK. So it's understandably having a devastating impact on African countries. And I think it's also important to note that comparatively speaking, the numbers of COVID cases have been relatively low on the continent, with the notable exception of South Africa. But still, relatively speaking, South Africa has about the same amount of cases as Florida, which is one state in the United States. So I think it is important to put it in that context, that African countries have, relatively speaking, been able to prepare better because of their previous experience with other pandemics, and because COVID came to the continent relatively late. But there is also the aspect of perhaps the lack of testing. So there could be numbers that we just aren't identifying because of the lack of testing. At the same time, the adverse socioeconomic impacts across the continent, I think, are quite severe, and something that I may disagree a bit with Yusuf on. I think that the economic consequences of COVID may well outlast the virus itself, with a disproportionate impact on vulnerable communities, particularly women and the poor. And so I think that is something that we should focus on. Obviously, The immediate concern would be mitigating the immediate harm of COVID-19. But I think it is critical to look at the long-term effects and perhaps use this moment to reimagine and to address some of the long-term governance issues and structural inequalities and weaknesses that this virus has really exacerbated and exposed. I have a lot of other points, but I'm going to pause there because I think the panelists have laid out a really great picture and we can go into questions now.
Well, great. And let me actually now pose an additional question myself and maybe go in reverse order. So Desiree, since you were so succinct, I'll allow you to speak next and invite you to add some of your additional points. But I guess as I hear you all, you know, I'm still trying to place COVID in relative perspective. Now, I was a Peace Corps volunteer in the former Zaire in the 1980s. Back then, the big problems were HIV/AIDS, Ebola, chloroquine-resistant malaria, and poor maternal and child health care, leading to a lot of deaths. And those remain issues in Africa, most of those. And most of them remain much more serious than COVID-19, as best I can understand from your answers and from what I know about the topic more generally. And therefore, I'm still trying to understand what the top public policy requirement should be, that we should be using this crisis to focus on and to address, because it seems to me Africa has so many challenges, and you've touched on them, the need for innovation and investment and stronger infrastructure, stronger institutions, protecting legal rights, gender rights, healthcare capability. COVID-19 is almost just one more insult that Africa didn't need, but luckily it's doing pretty well so far with it, at least in healthcare terms, I'm hearing you all say. So I guess my question is twofold. One, do I have it right that at least so far, knock on wood, COVID-19 probably is not anywhere near Africa's biggest healthcare problem, even in 2020, even as we speak? And then secondly, what is, you know, given that you've talked about the law and gender and the economies in Africa and the debt problems and the lack of government resources and the shutdowns in some of the cross-border economic activity that have resulted from COVID, what big new idea is needed on the economic front to mitigate the effects of this crisis if it's really at this point more of an economic problem than it is a health problem? So again, some of you touched on these questions, but I think they're so important that I want to come back and ask you to take another crack and add some more additional perspective to what you've already said, starting, if I could, with Desiree.
Sure. You know, I think a lot of the lockdown measures that many governments took were criticized for being woefully out of touch with the reality of many countries, right? So a lot of the containment measures that worked well in the West and that were the hallmarks of the coronavirus response, such as regular hand washing and social distancing, raised real practical and equity concerns, given the limited and unequal access to clean piped water and the density of the urban poor. And furthermore, a lot of the vast majority of the labor force in Africa is employed in the informal sector. And a lot of those folks are dependent upon daily work, going out to markets, daily vendors, informal vendors for their livelihoods. And so a common refrain you hear from Africans is that I'm going to die of hunger before I die of COVID. And so putting into measures and using a sort of copy and paste approach from other countries really hampered not only the health response to COVID, but I think has even worsened the economic response. And so I think in order to mitigate the long-term economic impacts, there's going to have to be some ingenuity. It cannot be another copy-paste approach from what other countries have done. I think this is now an incredible opportunity for a sort of broad stakeholder engagement, bringing in civil society, entrepreneurs, the youth, to come up with African solutions that that would be relevant and applicable for the context of the continent moving forward. And I don't know what those answers are, because it will vary by country. And I think that that is necessarily so. I don't think we can use a one size fits all approach when it comes to the health impact of COVID, as well as the economic recovery.
Zoe, if I could go to you next, please, and then I'll go to Xander and Yusuf.
Sure, thanks. I agree with much of what Desiree has just said. I was just taking notes and trying to organize my thoughts. I think I broadly agree with your characterization, Mike, and I generally am not one to sort of ambulance chase, particularly in a continent where there's such diversity of countries with so many complex problems. I've also been doing work for the past several years in Nigeria, and even just thinking about a sort of centralized federal response to something like COVID makes no sense, right? That what's happening in the Northeast looks numerically like some of the outbreaks that you're seeing in the South-South, and the way that you would manage that would be very different than what you would do in Abuja, for example. But that said, I do think that there is a really unique threat that COVID poses. And I, you know, I'm a little bit out of my depth when I start thinking about viruses and thinking about medicine. I'm a political scientist by training, but we have no really effective treatment or vaccine or cure for COVID. And there's not one on the horizon. And I have very serious concerns about African countries' ability to access and distribute one when it becomes available. And so, you know, I've been trying to follow some of the numbers around where do we see, you know, where are we seeing various gender gaps in coronavirus globally and then in African countries specifically. And 70% of healthcare workers in Africa are women. We know that the vast majority of people being infected with coronavirus amongst health workers in the United States, where we have data, are women. So 73% of health worker infections in the US are among women. And I think we can expect similar numbers if we start seeing high coronavirus treatment loads in hospitals across the continent. And so what I'm concerned about is really just the impact that would have on nurses and doctors and even community health workers across Africa. We know from Ebola in Sierra Leone and Liberia that more than 8% of health workers died from Ebola, whereas the death rate within the general population was between 1% and 2%. And so that kind of an impact is just devastating on already weak health systems that are undersupplied in terms of trained nurses, doctors, and other health workers. So that's my first concern, is that that is different if we lose a significant proportion, even if it's a relatively small proportion, you know, that reduction in ability to care across Africa, it takes years to retrain those people and to replace them. And that doesn't even count the loss for the community and within the health system, the morale hit. So I think that's a really serious concern that we need to take seriously, even though, like you said, you know, tuberculosis, HIV, AIDS, malaria, these continue to be global challenges that some African countries are disproportionately challenged with. The other thing I want to point out is, I'm really nervous about how African countries can access foreign exchange without opening their economies and making themselves vulnerable to these global vectors of coronavirus. So whereas Ebola and Lassa fever and some other tropical diseases that have kind of been historically neglected, they tend to hide out in rural communities and they don't travel as quickly. So we know that during COVID, Eastern Congo was able to eliminate Ebola, right? So there was this huge epidemic victory in the midst of a global pandemic. There are a lot of lessons that have been learned, but they've also been learned mostly for some of these more kind of remote epidemics. And coronavirus comes in on an airplane, right? It flies into a city and it flies into regional hubs where we've otherwise been trying to leverage some of that technology and investment and connectivity to generate regional economies within Africa. And so I'm very worried that African countries are stuck in a bind where they're forced to open these regional hubs and forced to trade with Europe and forced to have flights open up to China to increase access to global supply chains. And that's intrinsically the kind of the vulnerable, the Achilles heel, the vulnerable spot on the continent for more and more coronavirus to come in. And then it travels through these care workers where you see women disproportionately represented. So there's a lot that I could say about kind of disproportionate vulnerabilities and how it affects kind of migrant workers who might be primarily men But I kind of want to leave it there and just say I do think that this is different, even if the numbers are not as significant.
Thank you. Very helpful. Xander, over to you, please. Same set of questions, if I could.
Okay. To continue on something that Zoe said, this pressure to reopen the economies is really strong. And we see this in South Africa. I mean, South Africa was originally lauded for taking direct measures that seem to initially curtail the spread of the virus there. Now, people can debate whether they were excessive or not, but things seem to be under control numbers-wise. And then with the economy taking a really hard turn down, they reopened, and then we see what happens with their numbers explode. So this pressure is real. I absolutely do think that the economic effects are what we're going to see for years and years to come. And we already see this in the numbers now. Africa, again, we're making generalizations here, and I hate using that term, but we're forced to today. You know, growth has been nearly at 3%, I believe it was 2.9 last year, overall growth. And the numbers for this year, 2020, are predicted to be -2, maybe even -5 continent-wide. That's not something that just turns around, especially when the issue that is causing it is not really endemic in Africa, right? This is happening with Africa's trade partners. This is happening with China. This is happening with the United States, right? So even if COVID is gone from the continent, that doesn't mean like this, that trade can pick back up. But at the same time, I think we see a real opportunity here. Before I move to that though, like an example just of some of these long-term effects, if we just look at the airline industry in Africa. So just that one snapshot, okay? That has been one of the areas of great success in recent years. Not only Ethiopian Airlines, but we've seen other airlines expand their services and things like that. And, you know, a recent article pointed out, of course, South Africa Airways has been in some financial difficulty since 2019, but we see Air Mauritius has announced that they're going to put the airline into a voluntary administration to try and salvage it. Rwanda Air has announced it will slash net salaries of its staff between 8 and 65%. Kenya Airways has also seen cuts. However, it's converted some of its passenger flights to cargo flights. Why? Humanitarian aid and trying to keep some of these trade routes open. Ethiopian Airlines has done the same. But if you think about the impact that an airline has as far as all of the economic generation around it with related to trade, but also the jobs created by it, stable jobs, things like this. If we lose those airlines due to the lack of trade from this disease, to rebuild them is not an easy feat. And then that's just one tiny little piece of this longer term picture. But to the opportunity, things that have been going on that don't have to do with COVID on the continent would include the African Continental Free Trade Agreement, you know, which was signed a couple of years ago, has 54 signatories. On July 7th, that was supposed to be the commemoration of African Integration Day and celebrating the coming into force of this new agreement and this look of having a continent-wide trade economy. I think that as far as opportunities go, one thing that we may see come out of this is in conjunction with what's been going on for years of developing a continent-wide trade and free trade regionally as well, more looking to their fellow countries on the continent rather than to those outside trade partners. How can we strengthen internally trade between countries? How can we promote products on the continent to be sold on the continent and not be as reliant on outside sources? I mean, that's not an easy fix, but if there were ever a good time to do it, this may be it, considering that some of our trade partners are going to continue to be hesitant or be dealing with their own difficulties in the next few years. This may be that time, if there ever were one, to harness that opportunity.
Excellent. Thank you. And Youssef, over to you for any further thoughts on how to place this crisis in perspective and what big next steps might be needed in policy terms to address all the kinds of ripple-on effects that are occurring.
Yeah, I really see three areas of policy intervention. The number one, I think roughly speaking, we clearly see that the countries that have been focusing on prevention and diagnostic have done better than the one that have been focusing on treatment and post-treatment. And that's one clear picture. So I think one area of policy intervention is really to foster the reform of healthcare system in Africa so that there is much more emphasis on prevention and diagnostic, what we call actually personalized healthcare or precision healthcare. And I think this is valid for HIV, Ebola, and any pandemic. So we have to really focus on prevention and diagnostic. The second area of intervention that I see has to do with the scaling up of startups. So basically, we need to have an environment that enables high-performing startups on the continent. And this requires two things, a national, transnational, and also transcontinental collaboration and partnership, because we made an estimation on how much money we will need for the continent to transition to the fourth industrial revolution. And we are talking about $20 trillion. So where do we get that money? And this is what we need to have those high-performing startups on the continent, because it is this type of startup that will impact the GDP of the continent, and as such, that will impact the capacity of the continent to face future shocks. The last area of intervention that I see has to do with what I call new economies. So climate economy, the carbon economy, the methanol economy, hydrogen economy, circular economy, shared economy. So how do we harness those economies? And I think what the pandemic has clearly shown is that we really need to be able to develop or to harness those economies, because those are the type of economies that will help each individual countries to be much more resilient. For instance, if you adopt today the hydrogen economy in one country, you become energy independent. And this is a very important aspect. If you develop circular economies, the same thing, you become more resilient to breakdown of supply chains. So we need to think about fostering the adoption of those new economic models. So those are the three areas of policy intervention that I see post-COVID-19.
Excellent. Well, thank you. So we have just under 20 minutes now for questions from the audience. And I think what I'm going to ask the panelists to do, if you have a notepaper or at least a good memory, is I'm going to run down the list of about a half dozen questions. And please make note of the one or two that you think you could speak to most effectively. And we'll just have one final round of responses from each of you after I put all these questions on the table. And some of them lend themselves more to one of you than another. So, we can have a couple of people speak to some of these questions, but bear in mind, we're only going to have about 15 minutes total for the panel to address them. One question is about the U.S. private sector and what can the American private sector do to help Africa-led initiatives to respond to the crisis, but also to address and go on with some of the priorities you've been talking about already today in terms of building types of African economies that are more resilient, that are more dynamic, that can handle this sort of problem. So what can the U.S. private sector do? Another question is about testing, maybe more along the lines of what Zoe was addressing earlier. And also Desiree, you had both talked about testing and uncertainty about rates. But with testing at such low rates in places like Nigeria, what are some of the ways we could try to get a more accurate sense of caseload? And then building on that first question and thinking about investment, the question is simply the third question, will Africa ever be the same for investors? So how are longer term economic opportunities changing perhaps because of COVID, if you think that's a valid premise? Fourth question is about humanitarian aid and whether that is something where we've seen a major change in international response. Or maybe the more important question is, how do we get more financial and macroeconomic aid to these economies that have suffered the kind of, and are suffering the kind of GDP contraction that Zander talked about a minute ago, with concerns about -2% to -5% GDP growth this year in many different countries on the continent. Fifth question is about Morocco. And in April, questioner poses or points out, Morocco launched an African initiative for a concerted management of the pandemic and sent supplies to 15 countries. Is that a good example of what could happen more, if anybody is familiar with that particular case? And then finally, wrapping these questions into longer term questions of sustainability and development. You know, again, many of you have touched on this issue already, but the question is, how is the pandemic affecting sustainability planning? I guess there actually are two more questions. One is about NGOs and how they can harmonize their efforts. Are there any opportunities for NGOs to work together more effectively, more synergistically, given the nature of this crisis and given the number of actors that we know are involved in Africa already? Finally, given the Ebola outbreaks in West Africa, how do you see capacity issues with COVID and Ebola together? This gets to the broader question of how we think about COVID-19 in the pantheon of all the healthcare challenges that Africa already has. But are there any specific aspects concerning Ebola that you would try to take lessons from or look for opportunities? And just as I was speaking, final question has come in, and then I will stop. And again, with apologies to those who have posed questions, we're not necessarily going to get equally detailed answers to every question, but I wanted to get your questions before the panelists, and they can pick one or two each to address. But the question here to finish: Africa has the most serious hunger and food insecurity issues of any place on Earth, at least certainly among the most serious. How has COVID-19 affected agricultural production and food distribution within the countries themselves and across the continent? So with all of that, big mouthful, let me now turn things over, starting, I guess we'll go in the order that we began with today. So Youssef, if you could address one or two of those questions, please, in about, you know, 3 or 4 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you. So maybe I will choose the one on will Africa ever be the same for investor combined with the role of the private sector. What I can say for sure is that the problem we are facing today, and I would like to focus on science entrepreneurship, which means innovation based on scientific research. We are investing in Africa less than 1% in R&D, and therefore we have a deficit of skills, a deficit of knowledge, and a deficit of technology because of the fact that we don't invest too much in R&D. That's where I think the US can help, because they can bridge that gap by giving us access to early ideas of startups. And those startups, they can then let's say, scale up if they are interesting. I mean, they can be scaled up on the continent. And again, we will benefit from technology transfer from the US to Africa, from the US private sector to Africa. We will go on for scaling. And then if the idea is has some opportunity to be commercialized, then there is an opportunity to transfer back the technology to the US. Now, the reason why this circular scheme of it could be interesting is that the framework to scale up innovation in the US is much more rigid than the framework that we have in Africa, which is much more favorable. So in one of the papers that I wrote, I explained how, for instance, Zipline was an idea that came from the US, was piloted and scaled up in Africa, and then brought back for commercialization or high-scale commercialization in the US. So we need to be able to replicate this type of model. So I think I will probably stop with this and to give more room to my co-panelists to also address some of the questions.
Thank you. Xander, over to you, my friend.
Sure. So I'll take the one about humanitarian aid and maybe macro level interventions. So the international community earlier on in this crisis was continuing to give aid, but as I think someone mentioned earlier, there is now some pressure for those governments not to be given aid when they need to do aid at home. I mean, we can think of, I'm speaking from the United States. The United States has had a problem providing PPE for its own medical workers. Now is not a time when the United States is going to be able to send PPE to outside the US. So what can governments do? Well, there has been a lot of talk about potentially restructuring or otherwise changing the payments on loans to governments, because many countries in Africa do not have the same sort of economic resources of liquidity or flexibility in the ability to budget as perhaps some other economies do with more stable currencies. So can we think about pushing back institutional loan payments? Can we think about restructuring debt or forgiving even some of the debt? And this is particularly an interesting question when one thinks about it from both sides. So China and the US being two big players in donating at that sort of institutional level, wouldn't this be an amazing opportunity for either China, the US, or you know, other partners to consider taking a bold move and saying, okay, and during this time, we're going to forgive part of your debt or something like that. So the United States, which in some ways, there have been other Brookings discussions of this, you know, China has eclipsed the US in its economic involvement on the continent in many ways. This would actually potentially be an opportunity for the US to come back and show leadership and rebuild some of its relationships with countries if it were to take a bold stand on the economic relief. And in doing that, because it's not a cash outflow or a goods outflow from the US or from some of these other countries, that might be easier for the European Union, United States, Canada, China, you name it, to take on at this moment, where they themselves don't necessarily have the funds to go out, but they could say, don't give me funds right now and consider this. And I think while we've seen for years calls to restructure institutional debt at the macro level, this might actually be one of those times where it could happen, because this is not something affecting just one country or one region. This is affecting the whole world. And I think we really need to raise those big picture questions and say, well, what if and why not? So I look forward to that aspect of those discussions.
Yeah, that's a really powerful statement. Thank you. Very compelling. Zoe, Marks, over to you, and then we'll finish with Desiree.
Okay, I'm going to try to be as efficient as possible. I might start, I try to take a couple of them together. So starting with this question about testing, and then also some of building off some of what Yusuf said and thinking about NGO harmonization and investing in local innovation. So I think that one of the potential innovations that we could see coming out of a lot of African countries with high digital connectivity, particularly where there's a lot of access to mobile phones and data, is we've seen WhatsApp and indigenous like newly generated apps being used really effectively, not only to disseminate information about COVID, but also to help, you know, we could see that transformed into an opportunity for self-reporting symptoms. And then if there are some communities that have relatively high testing accessibility and others that are using the app but don't have access to testing, you can basically do matching and see whether or not what's coming in from self-reports looks like what's happening in other communities that have either high or low rates of testing. And so you could imagine that there are ways to sort of make really well-informed inferences if we're using some of the digital innovations that African startups have developed already to not only share information about public health and COVID prevention, but also to start trying to identify early hotspots. And so that's one thing that I think would be fantastic. Now, thinking about what is like a NGO harmonization opportunity within this, I'd love to see NGOs doing two things. I would love, and I'm speaking particularly about international NGOs. One is to not just do the sort of ambulance chasing of everything they were already doing now being a COVID thing, or being shut down. But also the two things I'd like to see them do is one, take leadership from the incredibly well-coordinated regional responses that I think are being led at the highest level by Africa CDC. If you haven't been to their website and you're listening in, please check it out. They have a live tracker. They've developed a coordinated procurement system across the continent. I'm sure there have been hiccups. I know that for a week, their relatively reliable and informative press conferences were canceled because the Ethiopian internet shut down, which is incredibly counterproductive when everything is online. But the African Union CDC and letting the sort of regional and coordinated response guide what NGOs are doing to coordinate is really key for doing what Xander just mentioned, which is taking this opportunity to make fundamental structural change in who's leading initiatives on the continent. It needs to be Africans right now. And then the second thing I'd like them to do is to think about what are the initiatives that you're supporting and where is innovation coming from. And this is where I think NGOs are also really well placed to try to invest in some of these startups and digital tech initiatives that are innovative and have uptake at the local level because they're built for purpose and they're built in ways that are not only, you know, culturally resonant and accessible for people who maybe have literacy issues or who don't trust the government, but that it's really strengthening the social cohesion of a country. And then the last thing I want to say is not end on the bright spot of innovation and opportunities for multi-level stakeholder engagement, but there is a real challenge here with the digital divide. And a lot of rural communities, and particularly women, don't have access to mobile phones and don't have access to data and aren't able to access information that's not in their local language. And so, you know, I think that this is an opportunity and a challenge across the continent right now to really think regionally about how can we ensure that all African countries look like Rwanda, look like Kenya with data connectivity. Because if you can't access information, then you're stuck out of getting some of that data that I talked about at the beginning, where we have real-time updates in data disaggregation regionally, but you're also going to be disadvantaged when markets do reopen and when we start to see some of that regional economic integration that Sandra was talking about.
If I just may say one sentence, you mentioned African CDC. We want to look at bright spots here. They have been one of the most amazing ones. And we talk about institutions and infrastructure. And I think that that's a great example of a success. The work that they've done and that they will continue to do now that they've been tested in this environment. That's one of the bright shining lights, I think, to come out of the last few months.
Can one of you spell out the acronym just for someone who may not? You said CVC.
CDC, the African Center for Disease Control and Prevention.
And where is it located?
In Addis Ababa.
Great. Desiree, over to you for final thoughts.
Pressure. Okay, I will try to be very, very succinct. I'm going to address a couple of the questions posed. First, I'll start with what the U.S. private sector can do, since that was my most recent position with Albright Stonebridge Group. I think there's a large scope of things that the U.S. private sector can do, and this is now the time for them to engage, not disengage. I think it's critically important for U.S. companies to remain in African markets, not pull back, even though we are facing serious challenges here at home. That is understandable. But to the extent possible, U.S. private companies can play a huge role in the economic recovery by creating more jobs on the continent. So even before COVID, the continent was facing about a job deficit of about 20 million jobs. And that is a critical point to keep in mind, given the youth bulge, right? And so now there's a very real risk of additional jobs being lost because of the COVID pandemic. So to the extent that it's possible to create new jobs in this post-COVID world, that I think is going to be critically important. And one way that companies can do that is by bringing supply chains to the African continent. This is something that Yusuf touched on earlier, and I think is going to be critically important, especially given the point that Sandra made, that this pandemic is global, right? So even if and when Africa gets it under control, other markets and other trading partners may still be grappling with it. So given the rise of the African Continental Free Trade Area, I think this is a real opportunity to reimagine supply chains, and that is an excellent opportunity to create desperately needed, well-paying jobs. Quickly on the testing point, I'm no expert on testing, I'm not a scientist, but I will say that there's an opportunity to look at what has worked on the continent. Look at some of the innovative approaches to testing that have been taken in places like Senegal, where a $1 rapid test was locally produced. In places like Rwanda, where they are doing pool testing, which is a lower cost mechanism to test large numbers for COVID-19. And then I'll end on the NGO questions. NGOs and civil society are a critical part of this, particularly given the mistrust in between citizens and governments in many places. So I think NGOs definitely need to be at the table. They need to be using their voices and to the extent possible, harmonizing their efforts, given the very limited resources that many are facing. And I think where they can play critical roles include protecting the most vulnerable populations. That includes women, children, the elderly, but also migrants, refugees, sex workers, LGBTQI people, who have been targeted even more since the pandemic, particularly by overzealous security forces and police forces that have taken a militaristic approach to enforcing a lot of these lockdowns. And in doing so, have targeted poor communities and those already stigmatized in communities. I think NGOs are also going to be incredibly important to encourage transparency in government spending. One thing that we saw in the Ebola crisis, and I think is an important lesson to apply to this, to the COVID pandemic, is a lot of resources were lost and lives were lost due to corruption. And that is an unnecessary evil. And I think NGOs play an important role in encouraging government transparency and holding leaders to account, particularly in places where leaders are using the pandemic as a guise to consolidate their power instead of actually protecting public health. And I'll end there.
You four have been fantastic. I don't know how you covered so much in 60 minutes. I'm really privileged to have been part of this with you. I want to thank Luke and other friends at Out in National Security. I want to thank Zoe and Desiree and Xander and Youssef for excellent comments ranging from healthcare considerations to NGOs to gender and law to economics to the future of Africa writ large and the way in which the United States and others around the world can be part of helping build its future. So without any further ado, thank you. Very best wishes. Everybody stay safe. Have a good rest of the summer as we go forward. And our best wishes to friends around the world, but especially in Africa today. We're privileged to be partners with you on so many things we do together. And we wish you the very best. And we also compliment and commend you for the way in which you've limited the spread of coronavirus, frankly, a lot better than a lot of the rest of us have so far. And best wishes with that going forward as well. So thanks to all. Take care.